Yep.
Boy, a lot of the technology.
Yeah, this is more. This feels more sort of conversational.
Give it a go. You're popping on here.
Whoa.
Say something.
Who, me?
Yeah, you.
Am I popping?
No.
Of course not.
All right. Welcome back to a special session of Congress Two Beers In. I'm Josh Huter with Matt Glassman.
Yep, here we are in the Obama room.
In the Obama room, and this is our outgoing colleague, Mr. Mark Senior Fellow Harkins.
Yeah.
Is going to take the road to retirement.
Yeah,
short-termer. Short-termer. Another whole 2 weeks.
Yep.
At least one of which is vacation, so, you know, you can't take that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty good stuff.
I know. So we thought we'd just pepper you with questions about your history in general.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wondered why we didn't do any lead-in.
I said, yeah, we're not going to do anything special. What we're going to do is just ask you about your job. So what do you think has changed the most since you have, one, started on Capitol Hill,
We have prior questions.
Okay.
What was your first job on Capitol Hill?
Right. Very first job, 1989. I was the computer operator for Pat Williams from the 1st District of Montana, when Montana had 2 districts. I know they do again, but they didn't for very long.
Does that job even exist today?
No, what is... I was about to say, that doesn't
computer
exist.
Operator. It's
now that sounds called, like a fake job.
It's now called a systems administrator, but back in the day, we had... Back then, okay, so this is 89, we had a tower, a computer tower, and then dumb terminals. Not everybody had there weren't laptops on everybody's desk back in the day. And so my job was to make sure that the stuff worked right. Mainly my job was to make sure the right names got on the right letters that went back to Montana.
You were in charge of making sure the computer was plugged into the wall and typing.
Interestingly enough, I had enough of a background. Oh, here was the best part. Best part. I walk in day one, right? Come into the job, sit down, and people start coming up and asking me questions about how the computer works. And I'm like, this office has been here for 10 years. What the hell is going on? They change computer systems the day I started.
Amazing.
They change from one Word program to a different Word program. Everybody knew how to cut and paste in the old program. Nobody knew how to do it in the new program.
It's like WordPerfect 2.2 or something.
It was like from WordPerfect to Word, or the other way around, or it was whatever the Utah product was back then. That was.
I mean, you're not dealing with any internet issues or anything like that.
No.
But this is a local area network.
Local area network in your office, and we had 11 people in the congressional office, in a Rayburn office. It was tight.
And this isn't a Windows-based system either, is it? It's like a DOS-based
system.
No.
Yeah. Well, Unix.
Oh, my God.
Even better.
It was a Unix box. And we didn't have any access to the
software.
5 1/4
disks, 3 1/2 disks. What kind of disks were you putting in this thing?
I don't know that we were doing... See, again...
Aren't you the expert?
They were doing...
Disks did not exist yet.
The disks were sold.
Magnetic tape?
Hell, I had a computer that had an 8-inch disk at one point. You don't even want to get me started. But you had your vendors... who handled everything, right? You had no access to the actual underpinnings of the software. If there's any problem, you had to call the vendor, basically say it. And I taught the vendor some things. They were like, this is a problem, and this is how you can fix it. They're like, really? I hadn't thought about that. So
89 puts you in the House prior to the big scandals. Prior to the banking scandal, prior to the post office, prior to the speaker.
Did you watch Jerry Wright go down?
I did.
The big scandal starts went down
in July of 89.
Yeah.
And he was tight with Williams, because Pat Williams was the unofficial labor whip.
Jerry Wright got in trouble for making royalties off of book he wrote.
Jim Wright.
Got in trouble for getting royalties off a book he sold.
So you have to remember, back in the day, these members...
They were ethics.
Shaky ethics, because they could take honorarium.
Right.
They could take up to a percentage of their salary in speaking fees, and they would go places and speak.
Yeah.
And so they could have some of these outside deals and do things. And so that was kind of the thing. So what Wright did is he wrote this book, and then he made everybody buy it.
Right.
And that's why it was a royalties problem, is because he was forcing... You know, all the lobbyists were buying thousands of these books, and then you'd find them in the dumpster, right?
So people talk about how the pre-95 House was run on a little bit of a looser financial platform, but it's really sort of like the pre-91, 92 House that was really run with the old-fashioned perks and the lack of sort of modern ethics rules. They really start post-Wright scandal, post-office scandal, post-house banking scandal, probably the biggest one. But this is where, you know, Gingrich was walking around pushing, you know, with the ice buckets or whatever, modernizing that sort of stuff and getting the, you know, CAO in there.
You've got to sit back and tell people what you're talking about because they're not going
to
believe
it. Yeah, so prior to 95, the house was really not modernized in any sort of financial sense. You still had all the old patronage
jobs. Oh, I'm talking about the ice buckets.
We'll get to the ice buckets. Okay. And you get in the elevator. There's someone whose job is there to sit in the elevator and push the buttons. It's purely patron's job. The Capitol Police are still patronage jobs. Harry Reid was a Capitol policeman, right?
Yep.
Gingrich comes in, and he's going to modernize the house. Did a lot of good on the financial side. They got to audit the books. We stopped wasting money like this everywhere. Sort of professionalized place. His signature thing, though, was the ice deliveries, because every office prior to 95 in the morning would get a delivery of a bucket of ice outside the office. And I would say four-fifths of staffers didn't even know what the ice was for.
Right.
It would just show up every day. I never saw the ice. You saw the ice.
Oh, yeah. No, we got the ice. We had the ice come in every day, and then you could ask for a special delivery in the afternoon.
What'd you do with the ice every day?
Well, in the afternoon, you put it in your drinks. But in the morning, I mean, you have to remember that this goes back to pre-refrigeration. And so this is what people use. And because we used to drink water out of that water fountains and out of the faucets.
So y'all didn't have refrigerators in the offices?
That was interesting. They had taken...
When you say pre-refrigeration, I'm like, what?
By that point, we did have refrigeration.
Okay.
The ice buckets was still a thing. That was going on, but it was for basically people use it to chill drinks. I mean, that's what.
Physically do with the ice bucket each morning when you open the door to the office?
You took it and you put it into the little back space, which was every one of these offices had a kitchen that was put into it and a bathroom. There used to be there's a bathroom for the member and a bathroom for the staff in every single one of these offices, and all the bathrooms for the staff by the time I got there had been repurposed. They'd taken out all the stuff, and that's where your computer equipment went.
That's where we put our assistant communications director when I was on the
and occasionally the repurposed
bathroom.
And occasionally you would put staff back there, too. That's true, if you had a lot of staff. But you would have a sink and a small refrigerator area, and that's where you took the buckets back there, and that's what people used them for, whatever they would use them for. But yeah, most of the days, by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you were pouring out ice water every day.
Yeah,
and you didn't put the ice buckets back outside. No. You know the people who clean up the offices would come back and take the ice buckets and bust them every
day. And what time in the morning would the ice be there when you?
Before I was there, before 9 a.m. I mean, it was somebody in the architect of the Capitol's office. They wheeled that stuff around before members showed up.
How long did you do the systems operator job for?
I did that for a little bit over a year, and then I realized that of the 11 people in that office, there was me and one other guy who were not from Montana, and there wasn't a lot of upward mobility if you weren't from Montana.
Did you take that job planning on trying to go up the track? I mean, was your goal to be in L.A., or what was...
Yeah. I mean, eventually my goal was to be in L.A., and I was just happy to get a job wherever I could. I mean, the good sense for me, and what I tell people when I'm helping them try to figure out how to get a job, is if you have a skill set, use it. And so I had been the sports information director at my college the year before. It was a one-year internship. After I graduated. And so I had to lay out all of the programs for all of the events. And we had like 23 sports. It's ridiculous for a school of 1,200 kids. But I had to learn how to do this. So I learned how to use a program that back in the day was called PageMaker. And it was PageMaker version 1.0. And so the Williams office wanted to bring in somebody who understood a little bit about computers and could lay out newsletters. That turned out that, plus having worked on a campaign and having a recommendation letter from that campaign, which was David Price, was enough to get me the first job that I interviewed for, which is unusual in Washington.
And where'd you go from there?
So from there, I called back to Price's office and said, these Montana people are crazy. You got to get me the hell out of here. And there was no room in Price's office. He was just in his second term. But the chief of staff there did, I guess, put out the word, and about 4 weeks later, I got a call from a different North Carolina office saying, hey, we've got a...
Price's second term was 1991? 93?
Was
89-90.
First go-around first in the house.
Yeah, because his first go-around, because he was first elected in 86, so 80, yeah. 87, 88, which he and Pelosi were elected at the same time.
Yeah.
They were hiring for a computer operator LC. And I'm like, okay. And it was for North Carolina. And so I put in my app for that and got that job. And the day I said yes to the job, one of the LAs took a job with Lloyd Benson in Texas. And so the chief of staff said, hey, congratulations, you can have this job. I'm good, by the way, going to advertise the LA job and the computer operator LC job. And whichever one we fill, you get the other one. So I found two of my friends who knew how to do something with computers.
Yeah, get in here.
And had them apply. Yeah. And so I got a battlefield promotion and became an LA as opposed to an LC when
Smart.
I first
it's
when
amazing.
I made the move. I mean, you know, sometimes you're in the right place. Now, when I went and told Williams I was going to leave, and I didn't have that much interaction with Williams, and he hated to be called Williams, right? He was Pat. He wanted newspapers to quote him as Pat. He was just that kind of guy. But he was the labor whip. I mean, right? He was from Western Montana. That's the labor guys. Now, gun toters, but very, you know, minor labors. And I told him, yeah, I'm going to Tim Valentine's office. He said, that's great. You can take all those letters that I've written, you can take that same text and just put knots and no's in front of everything. Because Valentine was at the far other end of the Democratic caucus. I mean, he was a Southern Dem from North Carolina.
How wide was the Democratic caucus still in 1989?
It was incredibly wide, right? Yeah. You probably had the most conservative members were Democrats, and the most liberal were from also in the Democratic caucus. The fact, and then, so when you had 280 people, the Democrats had 260 to 280 people, they didn't really, right? Because the biggest change, when you guys asked me, and to go back to this, the biggest change is the fact that we don't have Democrats in the South anymore,
right,
who aren't African Americans or women.
So, you know, sometimes we talk about in terms
or
of
STICO.
Patterns of careers in the Hill, typically you work for a party and you don't really switch.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, mostly true everywhere, but very true in the personal offices. In the 80s, it was not a problem to switch from Southern Democratic office to a Northern Liberal Democratic office. Like that, as long as you were in the Democratic Party, as long as you were okay with it, there wasn't any sort of barriers to entry in the Southern Democrats or anything like
that?
Yeah,
no, there wasn't. And in addition, there really wasn't that. Sometimes you go moderate Republican too, right?
Mm.
You go back and forth. There was something called the Democratic Study Group, the DSG, back in the day. And that was kind of a political CRS, in a sense.
Yeah.
They produced a lot of materials for the caucus. And so, for instance, they would give you sample letters on an issue, whether it's a tax bill or a trade bill or anything, really, dealing with animals. Right, the PETA bill, dealing with cruelty to animals, and they would show you a pro letter and a con letter, both written by Democrats,
interesting,
to give you a background to go from. And you subscribed, you paid part of your members' representational account to the DSG, and they had like 30 or 40 staffers based off of these members' payments. And at least 10 to 15 of the members were Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
Who subscribed, and they were allowed to subscribe to the DSG.
What's amazing about that is like the Democratic Study Group started in the late 50s and really came up as like a liberal organization, basically at war with the Southern wing of their own party, right? They were like dedicated to like ousting them. And the fact that it just transforms over like a couple decades into something that's far more inclusive and far more informationally based, right? I mean, they were doing the same sort of stuff, but they were just distributing to liberals before. Whereas, like, by the 1980s, early 90s, right, you're talking about they were actually just liberals back then.
Progressive
was not a thing yet.
Okay.
But by the 1980s, 1990s, they're far more inclusive into who they're willing to share information with.
Until 1995, and going back to Matt was talking about before with Gingrich making the place better fiscally, one of the things he did is he did away with all those member services organizations,
mm-hmm.
all those different groups that tried to help with that, where members could pay some money into it, and he crushed the DSG.
What was your issue portfolio your first years in LA?
So when I came to Washington, D.C., I'd gone to the North Carolina School of Science and Mathematics. I was one of the first classes out of that geek school. It was a public residential high school, the first public residential high school in the country. And so I always wanted to come to Washington and try to help with education policy, because I felt like the state had given me 2 years of great high school education, allowed me to get to a liberal arts college in the Northeast, and I wanted to pay back the state somehow. So working for a North Carolina member, I had to do the education issue. So when I came in, I actually took it away from somebody else who really wanted it.
This isn't your typical office postal
politics.
And animals.
Oh my God, it was. Well, I came in as an LA, and the woman who left I ended up getting a lot of her portfolio. She went to Benson's office to do tax policy for a member of the finance committee. Dang. So I got all of the tax appropriations and budget issues.
Incredible.
So it's 1990. It's like May of 1990 when I'm picking up the budget issues.
Incredible.
I can't believe that fell in your lap. That's such
it's amazing.
Crazy.
How many LAs did Valentine's
like
that, office
in,
have?
In an office, like the appropriations budget stuff typically goes to a senior staffer. Sometimes the legislative director, the kind of person on top of the legislative LAs, they're handling that stuff directly. So for a new LA, all of a sudden just getting budget appropriations.
Not just a new LA to the office, a first time.
First time LA. First
time new to the brand office. New, yeah. Now you're from Carolina. So
I'm from Carolina. And I had Price speak for me. I mean, right. I had this Price office saying this kid's okay.
How many LAs are in the office?
There were four. There was the LD and three LAs. He was on the transportation in whatever.
Do you know?
It wasn't infrastructure there. It was transportation and something else back then.
Projects. Maybe. Pork projects.
TMPP. Yeah, it was pretty much pork projects.
Actually, it might have been.
The LD handled the transportation portfolio.
Okay.
It might have been Transportation Public Works or something crazy
like
that.
Yeah, I think it was.
And so Jack handled that. You have to remember, back in the day, it wasn't the same kind of job. Jack lived in Arlington. And he belonged to a pool. And every day at 1:30, he left to go swim for an hour.
In Arlington.
He left at 1:30, swam for an hour, came back at 3:30. It's like, what the hell?
That's amazing.
Jack did that. And then Ben was there, and there's one other. I think there's one other. Maybe it was just the three of us.
There's a vote on the floor.
The other committee he was on was the science committee. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I ended up getting the science issues. We really didn't cover it in the office. Well, we did. Then. Maybe I did because I came from the science and math high school, so I was like, whatever. And I think Ben had the environment issues, but I do remember stealing education from him and having all of these budget and appropriations things. So I've been doing this crap for a while. But remember 1990.
Right. Budget deal.
The budget deal. Yeah. We voted on a budget, a House budget, three times. The first two went down. It was only the third one that actually passed. And I'm in the middle of this trying to figure out what the hell's going on.
When you say three times, you don't mean like
the House,
there
on the
a bunch
House
of
floor.
Amendments. You're talking like
floor.
They had to bring up the bill three different separate.
And occasions. Leadership lost twice.
Queen of the hill,
They lost twice.
That's a full of years, right?
This is Foley.
So like there's like a mini rebellion in the Democratic Party, essentially.
It was the presages of what we were going to see a couple of years later. And I got this phone call from this one guy, and just a libertarian, just going off on the budget stuff. And I ended up stuck on this phone call for half an hour, 45 minutes. Because I'd had an econ undergrad degree, so I knew more. I thought I knew more than I probably did. But I knew enough to be able to talk with this guy. Mm-hmm. Swear to God, in 1992... 2 years later, I think it was 2 years later. I don't think it was that year. It was too late. Yeah, it was 2 years later. He ran against us. The guy I was on the phone with in 45 minutes ran against us on the Libertarian ticket. So he got like three votes.
So how much campaign work did you do as a staffer? I mean, I don't mean on the clock. I mean, but it was, I get the sense it was more common then for staffers to take leaves of absence to go do campaign work in the district. How much did you do?
Press people did that. Press people did that.
That makes sense.
Your substance people, your LAs, your LDs did
not.
So
you didn't do that?
I didn't do that then. The only time I started doing it is when I came back after 96. I did a little bit with Price. I actually put together a fundraiser. I was working because it's a fast forwarding. I worked for Valentine. Then Valentine was the chair of a subcommittee, and he sent me down to be his designee. And I worked on the science committee as a staffer for a while. And there's interesting stories about that. We can always go back to it if you want to. But then, of course, I lost my job in '94 when all Democrats, many Democrats, did when we lost control because our staff size on the science committee went from 65 to 15.
So you're on the science committee at this point.
In '93, '94, yeah. I was.
So that's not just the sort of shrinking because you're one of the minority. It's that plus the Gingrich cuts to the committees.
They killed everything.
And so
it was also a problem that we had more slots, but the 15 who stuck around all made a lot of money.
Right.
Yeah.
And we didn't have that much money.
Yeah.
And that was a problem. So then, we can get to the Price stuff later, I guess.
I mean, let's talk about 94 election. Where were you? And how much did you sense it coming?
This is the first time that Republicans won the House in 40 years.
Right. 40 years.
We had the, we had the Southern redistricting, and 92 made things look a little weird. But still, no one, my sense was no one expected it, even people sitting at this belly of the beast in the hill. Tell us about it.
I'm working for Valentine 90, 91, 92 is in L.A. And in 91, 92, there's a guy by the name of Doug Walgren from Pennsylvania, who's a chairman of a subcommittee. And for whatever reason, he got a seat on energy and commerce or something, so he left the science committee. And all of a sudden, Valentine becomes a subcommittee chair. And they had a guy handle his subcommittee stuff for like a year, year and a half, and he just went down and pissed everybody off. And so in 93, they sent him packing, and they sent me down to be the designee because they knew I could play nice with others, number one. But more importantly, I was cheap. And they wanted to split money between me and the LD so the LD can make enough money and then keep him in the office. So I go down there, and I'm the designee, right? I'm attached to Valentine.
Right.
So after 9 months, because of some other things they did.
Just to make this clear for people who are listening, like, you have committee staff and you have personal staff, but sometimes there are personal staff who are designated to a specific committee assignment. And so you're sort of on committee staff, but you're also
mostly paid by the committee.
But you're dedicated to a single personal office. Right.
I was paid by the committee, and I actually had a seat in the committee. It was the best seat I ever had. I actually had a view of the Capitol. Because in 93, they changed the jurisdictions around of the subcommittees. And they moved, and they had used to have energy and environment as one subcommittee, technology and aviation as another subcommittee. Turned out a guy by the name of Rick Boucher from Virginia, from deep western, southwestern Virginia, was slated to become the chair of the Energy and Environment Subcommittee. And he was a coal digger, right? I mean, this is what he cared about. They went nuts. And so the Science Committee moved Environment to the Technology Subcommittee. And so it ended up with Valentine. And all the staffers who handled environment stuff looked at Valentine. I mean, he's just a different Southern Democrat. He looked like Colonel Sanders. The white hair and the little pudge, right? And so they all left. All the staff left. So I get sent down there as the designee, and I'm handed the entire environment portfolio for the Science Committee on day one.
First time as committee staffer.
First time as committee staffer. And I'm the designee. I'm not even a committee. I'm the designee. I'm like, what the hell? And it took them about 6 to 8 months to hire anybody else up. And so I ended up with this portfolio, but this is why I got a good desk and got to see everything. So I'm down there doing this stuff, and after about 8 months, there was another personnel situation where they wanted to change stuff around. And so I got hired by the full committee. And so I no longer was tied to Valentine, which turned out to be great because 2 months later, Valentine announced he wasn't running for re-election.
Who's the chair of the full committee?
Chair of the full committee was a guy by the name of George Brown from Southern California, and he had been on the science committee for forever. He was into space stuff. Pretty liberal member.
Did a Republican win Valentine's seat?
A Republican did win Valentine's seat after he stepped out, and which made sense in that district.
So, and then George Brown handed things over to Bob Walker.
Because Bob Walker was the Republican.
Bob Walker, Republican
Bob
in Pennsylvania.
Walker waited his whole life for that one term as science chair.
Bob Walker waited his whole life to become the chair of the budget committee, and when they didn't give it to him, he ended up with the science committee. But, I mean, you know, some of our listeners may have had the opportunity to take classes where Bob Walker was a speaker for us, but the first couple
best
times...
Best stories.
Incredible proceduralist.
Yeah, he was amazing. And the first couple times I had to have him, it was like, because when I was in the majority on the science committee, he was the ranking member.
Yeah.
And he was a pain in the ass on the science committee.
Bob Walker made his career sitting on the floor saying, "I object," point of order, or reserve the right to object. Yeah. Either one of those three phrases. And he's caused hell for Democrats for years.
He's a testament to how valuable it is to know the rules, though. You know, there's not... You think more in the Senate, like, you know, Bobby Byrd knowing the rules. There's people in the House know the rules, but nowadays very few who go wield it the way Bob Walker did on the floor.
I was asked this recently, where it was like sort of somebody asked, like, do members know the rules anymore? I'm like, no, they don't know the rules. And, like, there's one thing to know the rules on the House floor, which is really kind of shut down now. Even if you know the rules, there's really nothing you can do. But there's another sense of knowing the rules where knowing when something's being pulled over you, right? When you don't even... understand when something is, when they say, oh, you can't do this, whether that's true or
yeah.
not. Or like, oh, this is okay. impossible.
Am I getting rolled or not?
Am I that wrong? Right. Am I just getting, you know, just getting BS shoved in right. front of my face and I don't know anymore? And that's true too, right? I mean, yeah. there's such a degree of ignorance about the rules and procedures of the House today that many people just don't know whether they can do something or not.
Yeah. Right? Bob Walker is single-handedly responsible for getting a handful of rules changed too, because he would be demanding division votes and teller votes and like every damn thing.
For people who like want to or are super procedure nerds, and I know there are like two of you out there, right? Like if you go look at the most recent House precedents, like everything is Bob Walker. It's like it's the chair talking to Bob Walker. It's just all over the place because he was a giant pain in the ass. So he was the ranking member
he was the on ranking the science committee
when you I were was on the staff. The
so where were you election night 94?
So where was I election night 94? I was probably up here in D.C. I was newly married. What was interesting is actually not election night. What's interesting is, so I'm sitting at my desk on election day. It's probably 12, 1 o'clock.
You're thinking how things are going. What are you, and when you're
saying I'm not thinking about it at all because we didn't have any, on the committees, you had no sense that there was anything going on.
Right.
Because when you're on the committee staff, you're not focusing on individual districts or any thoughts of that. So I get this phone call from my best friend who had been in polling for a while. He called me up and said, okay, so we're going to lose the Senate. I mean, in 94, we all knew we were going to lose the Senate.
The Senate had flipped a couple times in the 80s.
Yeah. Right.
Right. So it was not necessarily uncommon.
Much more competitive.
So that was like, yeah, we're going to lose that. It was fine. Ollie North is not going to be elected a senator because Oliver North was running in 94 in Virginia to be a senator, and he lost. And then he says, and I'll never forget this, he goes, looks like we're going to lose, the Democrats are going to lose about 50 seats in the House. And I went, John, if we lose 50 seats in the House, I've lost my job. And he went, oh, I'm so sorry. That was 1 o'clock on election day. That's when I first had any inkling that there was a problem. That's when I found out, essentially, I was going to lose my job. I mean, I didn't actually lose my job until the end of December because there was I was competing with two other people for one slot.
That was a shock election. Right, I mean that was a huge shock election.
It was,
and you get that every once in a while. I mean, like, but for the most part, in a lot of these elections, you see it coming. I mean, like, I've talked to staffers in like 2010 who like started packing up their things in September.
The Democrats,
and like, people were like, "You've got to stop! You're making everybody nervous." They're like, "It's coming! it's coming down the day. Just get your stuff. Start making the
House Appropriations Dems offered me a job." In September of 2010. And I literally looked and said, are you out of your effing mind?
Yeah,
I want to be low man on the totem pole here.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I think I'll just go back to CRS. Thank you very much. Yeah. No, sometimes you see it coming, right?
Yeah.
I don't think... people who say they saw it coming in 94, man, I hope you wrote that down in some way you can prove you saw it before it happened, because I don't think many people saw
it. Yeah, it was a big shock.
There were two seats in particular that I thought were incredible that they flipped. One was in Kansas when Dan Glickman lost. Mm-hmm. Glickman had been around forever. He was a high-ranking Democrat on various committees, especially on
probably
science.
Ag.
Well, yeah, I don't know if he was on ag or not, but he was definitely on science.
Okay.
Foley lost, right?
Yeah.
Foley lost, and that was just weird. That was the sitting speaker losing. And then how many people in his district thought that George Nethercutt was going to become the next speaker because it was their district? Like, it was not zero. It was like 30% population thought Nethercutt was going to be the speaker.
That's how it works, right? But like we got the speakership for this district.
It's for the district. So the next, but the other one that was a huge shock.
Washington 3, incredibly powerful.
Was David Price.
Right.
David Price representing Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Right.
Running against a guy whose name was Fred Heineman, who was a former fire chief in New York City.
Whoa.
So he did not have the Southern accent.
Right.
He beat David. And it was like, holy crap, are you kidding me? The votes totals were like 73 and some change to 72 and some change. It was a close election. But it was very low. And David said later, like 10 years later, he said, the number of people have come up to me who said, had I known it was going to be that close, I would have gone to vote.
It's
more than 1,000.
And this is something people don't internalize, is we have sort of all this high-level analytics, and there's polling in almost every district now. And in 1994, that was just much more sparse.
Yeah.
There was not good sort of national aggregation of this stuff. It was
District by district.
It's expensive to poll districts then and now, and there was just a lot less money around to poll the districts, and so
you weren't running campaign funds that were multi-million dollars. We're like $60,000-$80,000 for a poll was like
a lot of money. It wasn't the 19th century where there was no polling, but the polling was rather sparse, and you were still relying on people who had like a talent for judging the wind in districts,
right?
And those people can be off sometimes, but you didn't know, right, that it was going to be as close as it was. And I think there's probably, you know, there's probably plenty of districts that, like you described Price, where had they known they were in that much trouble, they might have been able to save themselves.
Right. I think that's right. And
that's kind of like the first election where you start to see the modern dynamic of like a midterm reaction to unified government, right? This is the first one where it's like the whole Congress is going to flip after you have unified government. And that really starts a trend. I mean, that's been consistent other than 2002.
That's true.
Since then.
Right.
I mean, it really is like the modern partisan electorate at that point in time.
And so you lose your job on the Science Committee, and what do you do in 1995?
6 months on unemployment. Got myself on a jury. That was good. That got me paid for 3 weeks. It was a Murder One trial. We hung. So that was good. But eventually, I got a job as a paralegal with a law firm that thought they wanted maybe think about doing some information for their clients on what was going on with Congress.
Okay.
And so I did a little bit of that kind of stuff too. But for the most part, I was, the first time in my life I was paid overtime. And I got paid triple time when I came in during the snow. But I did that for 18 months.
And then you get back to the Hill with David Price's.
So I put in two resumes to come back to the Hill. And if I hadn't come back to the Hill, I'd gone to law school. So thank God that David Price hired me. So I was the last hire into the office. So Price, who couldn't hire me before, right, because everybody was there and it was on staff, nobody wanted to give up their job. But once he lost and came back,
and he beats Heineman in
the rematch 150-130. Ooh. Remember those numbers I told you before?
Double the turnout. Yeah,
that's a lot. That's a big vote difference there.
It's a big vote difference.
That's crazy.
Big
vote. So he comes back.
He comes back. And
he wins 96. So this is January 97.
It's actually, I don't get hired until March. I'm literally the last hire into the office. They needed an approps person. He got himself back on approps.
Were you privy to sort of the negotiations for Price to get his stuff back and his seniority back and all that stuff?
Only in arrears, only after the fact did I hear some of that. I mean, it was basically, the argument was, and he had a good chief of staff who came in, a guy by the name of Billy Moore, who had been Chapman's chief of staff before that. And Billy knew how to work, and he had been a Wright guy way back when, so he knew how to work it. He was a Texan. And so he kind of knew how to work the system a little bit. But the argument was, does he get his seniority back or not?
Right.
And he lost that. He lost his seniority.
But he got the committee.
But he got the committee back, which was pretty good. But they had to fill this last spot, and they had three of us that they were talking to. One, appropriation staffer for like somebody from one of the Dakotas, but cost a lot of money. Me, who cost a medium amount of money, had some reasonable experience and knew the district well. And then a younger woman who knew the district really well, cost nothing but had no experience. And ultimately, they decided they had enough money to go with me. They didn't have nearly enough money to go with
the And Price's district is the district you grew up in?
It is. It's my hometown. Yeah. Chapel Hill is where I grew up, and that's where David lives. Still, to this day. He's still in Chapel Hill.
And so you're hired in Price's office as an L.A.?
As, well, a senior L.A. Senior. So there was no L.D. in the office.
Mm-hmm.
There were two of us who were senior LAs. And interestingly, every time I kind of negotiate my salary from here on out, I'm always asking for more money than they'll give me. And the tactic I say is, okay, we all know I'm worth more than this. So in 6 months, will you review me rather than wait for a year? And you know this is the target we're aimed for. The guy's like, yeah, absolutely. I think I might be able to help you in 6 months. And I'm like, great. And I took it. And every time, 6 months later, I was able to hit my target. The problem he had was the other senior LA. The other senior LA didn't make anything close to what I wanted. And we had to make the same amount of money. And he didn't have the budget to make it work to bring us both up. So as soon as I got hired, my good friend, Jean-Louis Beard, got a salary bump the same time I got a salary bump. So the two of us we handled the appropriations work. But that was a big office. They had a lot of people in that office.
And how did you find working in the minority all of a sudden? You'd never done that before. Sucked.
It would have if I was not on appropriations.
Yeah.
right? Because we're still in earmark land. And David was on the VA HUD and independent agencies bill. That was one of the two subcommittees he was on. The other one was Treasury Postal, and I got to handle VA HUD. And VA HUD, the independent agencies, there were 23 independent agencies that included NASA, NSF, CSP, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the American Battle Monuments Commission. I mean, we were all over the map with these 23 different things. The Institutes for Libraries and Museum Sciences. I mean, all kinds of independent agencies where lots of places where you could go drill for a little bit of money here and there.
Yeah.
And where people cared about what was going on. And for EPA, it was a big deal because we had a huge EPA research facility down in the district, which I had known about from my time on the science committee, which is also one of the reasons they brought me on. There was NASA, NSF, and EPA.
And so Price is still just a backbencher on appropriations.
He doesn't have a gavel. He's the lowest guy on the Democrat.
So he's a gavel.
Nowhere.
And so he's leaning on you staffing him on appropriations stuff. He doesn't have any access to appropriations staff.
And the most amazing thing, right, he doesn't.
Right.
And the most amazing thing we did that first year was they were building a new research and development facility down in North Carolina, or they wanted to. They needed, and I had worked on some of this in Valentine's office because we had to get the thing through Transportation and Public Works to allow for this building to occur. So I remember working that, and we actually had to beat the senators who were against it, our Republican senators, Jesse Helms, who was against expanding EPA's research and development facility down in Research Triangle Park, and we beat him, but it wasn't easy. I mean, Jesse Helms' famous quote was, "They don't need new stuff down there. You can just put them in some Quonset huts. It'll be fine." It's like, thank you, Jesse. But so fast forward 3 years later, and all of a sudden now we're trying to find a way to fund it.
Yeah.
I get a phone call, and so I'm starting in March. So I'm starting midway into the appropriations process. I'm not starting January 3rd.
Right.
They didn't hire me until like the first or second week of March. So I mean, as soon as I start my, you know, on Monday, Tuesday, I'm staffing hearings.
Right.
Appropriations hearings. So I don't know. They get to the point where they're writing the bill, so it must be late April, early May. I get a call from the clerk of the full committee, the Republican clerk, a guy by the name of Frank Cushing. Frank was scary as all get out. Idaho dude, wonderful human being, scary as all get out. Calls me in. "All right, this is what we're thinking." "Yes, sir." "Well, if we give $150 million to build that facility, you think your boss will support it?" "Yes." And so I go back to the office and I go, "Hey, Billy, I just gave away the store." He said, "What happened?" I said, they said they spent $150 million to build this facility down in RTP. And I said, "David would support it, but we probably won't get anything else in the bill." And Billy went, and he was gruff as hell too. And he went, "Good decision." So I'm like, I'm 2 months in thinking I'm about to have my ass handed to me.
Yeah.
How did the Lewinsky scandal go over in your office?
Didn't do much.
Yeah, Price was always just gonna back the president.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't as big a deal for us. Now, it was interesting for Billy because there's a story that when things were happening, so to speak, that the president was on the phone with a member of Congress talking about a project. And that member of Congress happened to be Jim Chapman. And Chapman tells a story that I thought he just thought the project was a really good project.
Jesus Christ.
Were you physically on the Hill on 9/11?
I was. I had gone back. So I was staying with Price. In 2000, Billy's retiring. David's got to hire a new chief of staff. He'd actually given us a year's advance notice that he was going to retire. Jean Louise and I were the obvious two choices, and David ultimately decided to go with her over me. And which, you know, it took me a few years, but he absolutely made the right decision. She was definitely the right fit for him, and she'd been with him since 1988 in the office. I was better on the legislative side. I had a better legislative portfolio. She was better with the people management stuff. And so I left to go to the Science Committee in 2001 because it was a little uncomfortable to be in the office.
Yeah.
It was because I didn't want to be seen as I was undermining her in any way, shape, or form ever.
Sure.
Because she to this day is my very good friend. And one of the few people in this world who actually knew my wife and me separately. Before we knew each other.
Yeah.
Because she went to Duke as well. And so I'm on the science committee staff in 2001. And we're in the minority. So now I do have a job for life. I don't have to worry about losing my job anymore. They can't cut us any more than this. But again, I was the budget and math guy. I was the guy keeping track of what was going on with the budget and stuff. And they gave me a couple issues. I had the environment stuff. Mm-hmm. And they gave me this, you know, internal, the science of kind of monitoring things about the security of the country, that kind of crap. But in January, February of 2001, it didn't really matter. It was a throwaway. In 9/11, there was a hearing in the science committee. I was not in the hearing. We were stationed, because we were the minority, over in House Annex 2, or the Ford House Office Building, which is across 395.
Right.
And I think I got into the office a little after 9. So basically the first plane has already hit before I get into the office. And we're kind of sitting, watching what's going on at the TV out front, and then we're watching as the second plane hits the other tower. And we're like, what the hell's going on? We're all kind of freaked out. We have a hearing starting at 10 o'clock, and this is, 9:20?
Where's the hearing? Up in
the hearing is in the Rayburn Building, in 2318, the main science committee hearing room. And our chief staff was over there for this hearing, for whatever it was. And then one of our two receptionists, these were older women who'd been around throughout the whole time period, made the cut to the 15 earlier, called in about, I don't know, half an hour, 45 minutes later, when the plane hit the Pentagon, because her husband worked in the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually had a doctor's appointment, so she was up in Columbia, Maryland. And I ended up talking to her on the phone. She was driving down to see her husband was okay. And I'm just like, Mary, you can't do that. It's crazy down here. You can't come down here. It's not going to do anybody any good for you to be here. You have got to go home, and you're going to have to hold on the phone. And she was about 2 decades older than I was, but I was able to calm her down enough and to get her to go home. And that was probably the best thing I did all day. And he was fine. He was not a part of the Pentagon that got hit. So then Chief Staff calls and releases us, right? And there was a false alarm about something coming in to the Capitol. But
this is all before the evacuation of the Capitol.
This is all before the evacuation of the Capitol. And then, I'm trying to remember if the evacuation of the Capitol happened when the plane hit the Pentagon. Because that plane came over the White House and was circling around. And I don't know if they evacuated it for that, because they weren't sure where that plane was going.
I knew a guy at CRS who was in a member briefing when they decided to evacuate, and the Capitol Police came in and physically grabbed the member, told the staffers what was happening, and just said, get out of the building, but physically dragged the member out of there.
Basically, women were being told to take their high heels off and run.
Yeah.
Maybe it was before that, because I don't remember being around for that. But I was over by Federal Center Southwest, if anybody knows that area of the blue. But I lived on the red line. So rather than go to Metro Center and change trains, because we're all freaked out, we don't know what the hell's going on, I walked to Judiciary Square to get on the red line. I walked up, you know, 6 blocks or whatever it was to get on the red line. And at some point, you know, there was a backfire near the State Department. Somebody thought the State Department was under attack.
Could you see the smoke at the Pentagon
from the wall? Smoke at the Pentagon.
Yeah.
Wow. Luckily, I was walking the other way, so it wasn't in my view all the time.
Right.
But hop on the train, and we get to Farragut North, and then we're delayed. And you're like, everybody's freaking out, right? It's after Metro Center, but everybody's like, what the hell is going on? And it was just a standard Metro delay, right?
Right.
I mean, you're sitting there for 1 minute. Everybody worried about the end of the world. And what is it? Is it Metro just being Metro?
We got fire and a transformer over by Grosvenor.
It was like 2 minutes, right?
15-minute delay.
Yeah. It's like we got a train stuck at Medical Center.
Now, my wife and I couldn't talk to each other. Right? Because the cell service was killed.
Yeah, it was like completely locked up.
Totally gone. This was my son's first day at nursery school.
Oof.
So it was one of these 15 minutes. And then my wife picked him up and took him to go to the playground. My wife tells a story about a nanny pulling up and landing on the curb outside of a place called Turtle Park. This is a big playground. and saying, we're under attack, we're at war, everybody has to get home. And it was a beautiful day out. I mean, it was a gorgeous day. It was one of these cooler...
It was a beautiful, beautiful day.
It was one of these cooler days in D.C. And my wife's like, well, we're in a two-bedroom apartment, and I have a two-year-old. If we're at war, I'm going to be stuck in my apartment for an awfully long time.
Yeah.
We're going to play until we run out of Cheerios.
Yeah.
And they did. They were out there until they ran out of Cheerios. I actually beat her home. But we could communicate because from a landline, I called her father, who had an 800 number in Tennessee. And she was able, from her cell phone, to call an 800 number. Huh. And so the two of us communicated through her father on this 800 line.
That's crazy.
Well, it was pretty nuts.
So how long did you stay on the science committee for?
So we're getting into November of 2002. So this is just one term. So November 2002, we've had 9/11. We've had anthrax delivered to the Capitol, which locked me out of my office for 6 weeks when I was on the science committee because the mail sorting machine
down the
three stories below me,
in the Ford
directly
building.
In the Ford building. The guy who died worked in that mail room. From the anthrax.
No longer true, by the way. That's all off-site now.
Yeah, right. They took it all off-site right after that. But let me tell you, that pear was a little ripe when I got back 6 weeks later. And we also had the shooter.
Yep.
We had Malvo.
Oh, the D.C. sniper.
The D.C. sniper.
Yeah. When was that? 2003?
Two. Early
that was two.
Over one and two.
Yeah.
So it's now November 2002. We know number two is on the way. My wife comes to me and says, go talk to Price. You've got to find a job in North Carolina. I can't take this anymore.
Mm.
So I do. So it's after the election. It's lame duck of 2002. And I go over to Price's office. I get a couple minutes with him. I get a walk and talk to a vote. But I have an ID, right? So, and I can say, David, here's the deal. Da, 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 da. And he goes, well, you're talking to Brad Miller, right? And I'm like, North Carolina had just gained a 13th seat through reapportionment in 2002.
In the redistricting.
In the reapportionment.
Yep.
And then the new district was the 13th district. That was, and I'd given $50 to this one guy because somebody told me he was the best guy to give to. And he ends up winning the seat. And I said to David, well, I hadn't thought about talking.
What part of Carolina?
So this was Raleigh up to the Virginia border, all the westward, and then down into Greensboro.
Okay.
So it was a gerrymandered district. That was a bunch of rural stuff, but the two urban centers. But the bulk of the district was, like 60% of the district was Wake County, Raleigh.
Okay.
And he was a Raleigh lawyer. And so I said, David, yeah, I haven't really thought about talking to him. He said, well, I've already talked to him about you. And I'm like, okay. And
David Price for the win, man. Yeah. What a guy.
I mean, he's my mentor, right?
What a guy.
And so I went and I said, okay. And so I went and I polished up a resume real quick. And I went to the Rayburn cafeteria, which is where all the new members have their little setups. And I went to drop a resume. And lo and behold, his one staffer who came up with him from the campaign is there. A guy by the name of Joe Bonfilio. Joe had been my intern 4 years before for Price.
Unbelievable.
He was the communications guy. And so luckily, I treat my interns well when I was on the Hill. Because
right.
Joe could have killed me right there. Former intern could have absolutely killed me right there. But, you know, I was able to, there were 10 of us who interviewed, and I ultimately got the job. And so then I was only in the science committee for 2 years because I convinced my wife to let us stay in Washington so that I could become a chief of staff.
What's it like chiefing for a brand new member? Tell us about starting up an office.
Oh, my God. There are a lot of things there. I mean.
New chief, too, right? First time in
chief,
the chief's job, right?
New chief. The interesting thing is that this was still back in the day when sometimes members would hire people with Hill experience rather than their campaign manager to be their chief. Now,
and that is a big tension.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of, you know, the party wants you to hire a Hill insider to break you to the saddle of DC and get you on their page. And most members want just the person who's most loyal to them, which is often in their campaign manager, in their district. And that is an absolute tension all over the place, both parties, everywhere.
But the campaign manager doesn't know left from right once they get on the Hill.
Normally not.
Yeah.
Normally not. Well, and this one was one of those guys. A 28-year-old kid ran staff meetings at 11 o'clock at night for 40 people. I mean, he was obviously not going to be the guy who was going to be running this operation. So I got lucky there. But so you've got a lot going on, right? Brand, not only all the other things, most times when you take over a district, you're taking over stuff.
Right. Casework. files.
Brand new 13th district did not exist before.
Yeah.
All of my equipment that I was inheriting came from a Connecticut district. I inherited two typewriters. I'm like, what the hell am I supposed to do with these in 2003? Right? So I'm having to build the entire whole cloth. Where do we put district offices? How do we set this up? Because nobody had done this before, right? Right? In this area. Had to hire up an entire district staff because there's nobody to hire from old offices.
So when you were hired, there was this intern who was doing comms?
Right.
How what else was there?
So I was hired the Monday before Thanksgiving, and then the Monday after Thanksgiving, I went down to North Carolina to interview people on the campaign who wanted to be in a congressional office. And
you had never done hiring before.
I'd never done hiring before.
Oh my God. and your boss had political experience or no?
He was a state senator. He actually had been the chairman of the redistricting committee for North Carolina for the state senate.
So he's not an amateur. He's not a total political amateur.
He's not a political amateur. Right. He is a federal amateur.
Yes.
And so he taught me the idea of gifts. A gift is a person who somebody recommends to you because they want to get rid of them. They give you a gift. And so he was pretty clear that anybody who was going to work in the district offices, he wanted to make sure that there was a background check, or at least a reference check, that was not a reference that they gave us.
Yes.
And he knew a lot of the people in North Carolina politics, so he could do that. What was interesting is he had a woman who worked for him in the state senate, who he was not sure he wanted to have on staff or not.
Mm-hmm.
And she wasn't sure she wanted to take that much of a pay cut. And I never interviewed her.
Interesting.
I never interviewed her. But yeah, so I interviewed those people. It was hard. I mean, the harder part, actually, I think, was getting on committees.
Interesting.
The hardest thing is getting on committees. Well, it doesn't just happen. You have to lobby vociferously to get on a committee.
And you've never done this before.
And
this
I've never
is,
done it before.
Brand new to
I
you.
I had no idea what the hell was going on. What's a steering and policy committee?
Yeah, what do you do to lobby members of a steering committee? Do you send them flowers?
You send them letters, right? Saying what you want to be on. Oh, by the way, you want to send them a letter on official letterhead, right? Because they want to look good.
You don't have any, though.
Oh, well, what happens when North Carolina decides not to certify the election until the middle of December? You can't get letterhead.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were like desperately trying to get letterhead, but we couldn't even get member-elect letterhead because our election
wasn't certified.
Can you
even get paid? Is the campaign
paying?
No,
I was being paid by the science committee still. They were nice enough to pay me.
I see.
They were nice enough to pay me. Ultimately, Miller ended up on the science committee, so it all worked out. But I was being paid by the science committee to do all this stuff.
Is this stressful or is it fun? Or how does this feel?
Well, when your wife is 4 months pregnant and you got a 2.5-year-old... Yeah, it had a little bit of stress to it, and I was not at my best. I was probably a little too controlling overall those first couple of years. But you know, you do what you can, and to hire the Washington staff, you know, I had 50 resumes from people who knew me or knew that I had become the chief of staff ahead of time,
mm-hmm.
and I looked at those. I had a box of 1,500 resumes from the Rayburn Building.
Unbelievable!
I never opened the box.
Unbelievable.
I never looked at the box.
Yeah.
Right? So when I tell people, you got to know somebody if you want to try to get a job. You got to know somebody who knows the person.
What's your order of operations here? Like, are you trying to hire an LD? Are you trying to hire a scheduler? Are you trying to hire a comms person? Well, what are you trying to do?
So comms is pretty obvious, right? It was going to be... And one of the reasons I got the job is because the other guy who was likely to get the job is a guy by the name of Brad Woodhouse. And some of you can look him up. Brad's a great guy. He had worked for Bob Etheridge. He's done a lot of stuff with Social Security and Medicare reform. He's a big name. His brother is Dallas Woodhouse in North Carolina. The two of them are polar opposites. Dallas has been the head of the Republican Party.
Incredible.
And there was one time when they were on C-SPAN. You should look up this clip. It's the greatest clip ever.
Woodhouse versus Woodhouse.
The worst house of Woodhouse, and their mother calls in.
Oh.
It is an awesome 3 minutes. You will love going and looking at this C-SPAN.
So that comms job's in place?
So that comms job, he was a comms guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so Joe really wanted me to get the job. So once I got the job, Joe's my comms guy. He's coming from the campaign. That's not going to be an issue. And he'd been an intern before. He knows shit, and it wasn't going to be a problem. The scheduler was critical, and that was the scheduler who came off the campaign. Her dad was the head of the State Employees Credit Union, which is the largest credit union in the country at the time. And he had blessed me out when I worked for Valentine at least once. Luckily, he didn't remember who I was. And Eleanor was like, yeah, it sounds like Dad. I'm like, yeah, pretty much. He burned me a new one.
Did you say blessed me out?
Blast me out. Oh, well, he could have been blessed.
North Carolina is out the ears. He blessed me out.
He blessed me out. That probably was what I said. What else did I have to hire up? And then I needed to hire up, you know, I really wanted a staff system, but it took a while to get to there. The next two big hires, of course, are your LD and your district director.
Yeah.
And those are the hard ones.
And you're doing all this before January 3rd, swearing, or you're waiting on some of this stuff?
A lot of it you had to end up waiting on. So I knew I wanted one district office in Raleigh. That was easy. That's where he lives. That's where we had to have our main district office. And you got to get that done early because the computer guys in D.C. have to know where to set up your main server in the district.
Oh. Nightmare.
Right? Because they have to hardline it in.
Yeah.
And so but again, we're not inheriting a space from a former...
Right.
Office.
Right.
We're having to figure this shit out.
Are you getting the casework files from the old maps or none of it's all
not yet
torched?
Because nobody knows. Nobody knew what the maps were. It's North Carolina. We were breaking up precincts when we were redrawing the map.
Did you ultimately get the casework files from where they were supposed to? I mean,
I didn't. Yeah. I didn't work with that side. Luckily, I was like, "That's why."
Wash your hands of that, and put that in the
LD. Some of this you got to hire away, right? So it's interesting. A couple of different things I did. So one of the big things I did is I tried to steal one of the top caseworkers from Price's office.
How'd that go?
Yeah, what's that like?
Well, let me just tell you, Jean Louise called. And read. And she blessed me out. She's like, "What? What are you doing?" I'm like, I'm sorry, but I need somebody. She said, all right, here's what we can do.
Yeah,
I'll give you Robin 3 days a week, okay, for the first 4 months until you get your legs under you. I'm like,
amazing.
Okay. And Robin liked working for us because I paid her more.
Yeah.
And so she was a part-time employee in the two offices. And so this is how I created my casework set.
How do you sit down with a new member and plot out sort of congressional strategy, both for the first term you're in Congress and then sort of more bigger? I mean, do you have conversations about career goals and things like that, or are you just trying to stay afloat for that first 6 months? Or?
So when I first went down to North Carolina, before I started interviewing people, I did have a sit down with Miller. And one of the first things I did is said, sir, people have to stop calling you Brad. I don't like it. I don't think it's right. Because everybody on this campaign always called him Brad. And I said, I don't care what they call you, Mr. Congressman or Mr. Miller or whatever, but I think they need to stop calling you Brad. And he said, well, okay, that's fine. I'll let that happen. Let me tell you what this... I mean, the campaign manager actually had disdain for the candidate, which was wild when I came into this. And so, first of all, I had to try to build that up. Then you do a ton of listening, right? I'm not telling him what his congressional career is. He's telling me what he wants to do. And I said, what's the first thing you really want to accomplish in your, what's the main thing you want to accomplish at the end of this Congress? And he said, having another term. And I said, okay, I understand. This is where we're going to start. Now from that, understanding that, what kinds of things do you want to do? And he said, I don't know. We're going to figure it out. I want to become the smartest at something. And become the resource person for that in Congress. Do you know what that is? Not yet, because I don't know what's available. I'm like, okay, we're gonna have some fun here. And it took a while to figure it out, but we got him onto financial services, which is not easy. And he found his niche on financial services.
Mm-hmm.
Good for him.
It was. But it took a while. But yeah, I mean, when you hire, you make some mistakes.
Yeah,
I made some mistakes. I got some right. I got some wrong.
Was he on financial services from the start, or did that take a term?
Okay, from the start, mm-hmm. which was
even, so he had science and financial services.
That was his first.
So he had two committees to start.
Right, and he wanted to be on financial services and foreign affairs, and I begged him not to be on foreign affairs.
So you've got 15 years experience in the Hill, roughly. You know,
12 at that point.
In that game, And you got a brand new member who's a state senator from North Carolina.
Yeah.
And so how much is he leaning on you for Hill knowledge and experience and things like that?
A ton.
So you're having an enormous amount of influence on sort of the early stages of this congressional career.
Well, to some degree, at least for the operational side.
Yeah.
He was a good operator, and he quickly met up with various members, and he became friends with a lot of people in the New Dems. He called me up on the bus to the retreat in February for the Democratic retreat.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, hey, I'm here with some guys and Chris. I can't remember Chris's last name. He was a new member from Texas. And some other guys here, and they want me to become a member of the New Democrats. What do you think? And I'm like, sounds good to me. If you want to do that, that's fine. At the end of 2 years, he came back to me and said, okay, so, you know, they're thinking about, I've got to think about whether I want to be a New Dem again. I said, boss, that's perfectly fine if you want to be a New Dem again. I just want you to know, you vote with them about 2/3 of the time. The 1/3 of the time you don't vote with them is on their key issues. So you just make up your mind what you want to do.
Yeah.
And after that, he was a man without an island, essentially, because he did not caucus with the progressives or the New Dems or the Blue Dogs after that.
What kind of member was he?
Very smart member. He always believed he was the smartest man in the room, and about 95% of the time he was right.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very sharp man. A little prickly, but good. The biggest problem I had with him was in correspondence. We'd send letters out to people, right? And especially building up that correspondence library at the beginning. I mean, I'm starting with nothing. Every letter that comes in with the constituents, I've got no answer for, and I don't know what his voice is, right? Everything's got to go through him. So I took some of my great processes that I'd learned in Price's office and, you know, put together the memos with the check yes, no boxes, hand it to him so he could take it on the airplane down to North Carolina, hand those suckers back to me when he came back, and we'd be able to get all this work done. He never checked them off. Never once would do that.
So what's that like when you have a member who's sort of not engaged with the kind of information processing that you need in order to staff them?
Frustrating.
Yeah.
I mean, and the staff was frustrated, right? And so our mail got way low, late. We got behind. Because first of all, you start behind because you've got months of stuff you got to deal with, and he wasn't answering anything. So I finally had to figure out, okay, this is a guy who's an oral learner.
Yeah.
In a sense, a lot like Trump. Trump's an oral learner. Yeah. Trump's not looking at a memo and checking a box, right? He was an oral learner. So every week we had to hold a meeting with the LAs for an hour, and they brought in their 3 or 4 cats and dogs, and he yes and no'd things, and that's how we got things done. But there was one, and then sometimes he would write the letters himself, and that was fine. He was a good writer. But this was our letter to people who were pro-life. One sentence that I'll never forget. My God does not deign to tell me when life begins. This is going to pro-life people. So I took the letter.
Not a delicate touch.
I went into the office. I shut the door. I said, boss, really, we got to take this line out. We can't. This isn't doing anything. You're putting a stick in the eye, people. These people aren't going to vote for me anyway. That's probably true. They're not. But do you want them to dislike you with passion?
Yeah.
Right.
This is what you're trying. This is what you will accomplish here. Yeah. And then we got into this, and this is probably February, early March, right? And then we got into this sequence where he always put a gotcha sentence into every letter waiting for me to take it out. And then there was, I swear to God. And there was one time where I just didn't do it. I was like, I left it in.
Oof.
And he's like, I didn't expect you to leave that one in. I'm like, it's your letter.
Yeah.
I mean, and that was part of the problem, right? There was this power dynamic problem at the beginning.
Yeah.
Where he's the member, he runs the place, but I'm the one who has the knowledge base,
yeah.
And I'm the one who can really tell you what's kind of right and what's not right. And over time, that started to flip enough that he got annoyed with me.
Yeah. And so you got hired in 2003 there.
You got hired in 2003.
Class 2003 member.
Yeah.
And how long do you chief for Miller for?
Until he got tired of me in 2007.
2007.
Because we ended up, I was positioning him to run for the Senate against Elizabeth Dole. And he was pretty well positioned to run for it. Fascinating meeting. So I go over with the LD, and the comms guy, and we go and we sit down in Harry Reid's office with Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer, because they were, because they're trying to feel out Miller about running for the Senate seat, and they're like, "Do you want to do this?" And he's like, "Do you want me to do this?" Right? Erskine Bowles wasn't going to run. Some of the other, Jim Hunt wasn't going to run. The A-list guys weren't going to run. And Miller's B to B minus list guy. And at the end of the meeting, we start walking back, and we're walking through the Dirksen building or whatever, and walking out. I said, "Do you think they understood that I need to be recruited?" I'm like, "Yes, sir. I think they understood that. Do you understand that they were trying to find out if you really wanted to do it or not?" And ultimately, the two of us got crosswise. I thought he should run. He was not clear whether he should run or not. So,
this is 06?
This was 07 for the 08
race. 08 race.
So 07 for the 08 race. And ultimately, the staff kind of got divided on it, too. Most of the other women thought he was a little too misogynistic, which I don't think was true at all. I don't think it was a fair characterization at all. He'd run against a woman for a re-election, and it got kind of ugly, but that wasn't really his fault. And because of the strife in the staff, he decided to lay that at my feet, and then he ultimately asked me to step down. And I did, so that was 07. And then that's when I ended up going to lobbying, doubling my salary overnight. Don't shed tears for me.
How long did you lobby for?
6 years, until they realized I couldn't raise money.
Couldn't raise money, huh? Did you like lobbying?
Not at all.
No.
Well, I mean, there were aspects of it I did. I liked the teaching people how to try to understand Congress, right? The clients.
Yeah.
And trying to understand, okay, this is what you want to try to get done. These are the people you got to try to get to. Trying to figure out the process for making what they want get done. That was kind of interesting. The having to constantly sell yourself. I can get this done for you, when you know in your right mind you can't. I mean, lobbyists can all the time overpromise, because it's the only way they're going to get business.
Yeah.
Which is, and I was never that guy. I never was going to go out and get business. I told people that. I serviced other people who brought in the business. But it was, the first place I worked for was the biggest law firm in North Carolina at the time, the only one that had a presence in D.C. And so we ended up with some North Carolina clients. And the law firm was the law firm for RJR. And so I was a Democratic lobbyist for RJR for a little bit. The guy who was the head of the organization really loved, he was kind of a conservative guy. He really kind of loved the defense industry. So we ended up having on our roster for a month, Blackwater. I walked Eric Prince around the Hill one day, to having him have meetings with members of North Carolina. That was a fascinating day.
Yeah. What do you see as the lobbying skill? Is it more connections? Is it being able to talk to people in meetings? Is it client massaging? What is the skill? All of that?
It's all, I mean, if you're really good at it, it's the ability to get your client's message into the right places at the right time.
Yeah.
Right? And be able to tell your clients when their message needs to be massaged. Because the clients always say, "This is what we want to get done." It's like, how about if we do this? Mm-hmm. That gets 80% of what you want. I might be able to get that. You can't worry about party. You just can't. You can't piss anybody off. And you can't play power, right? But some people are really...
When you say you can't play power, what do you mean?
You can't try to say, "Well, if you don't do this, I'm going to get the leadership to come down on you." I mean, you can't play power, right? I mean, you don't have the power. You've got to kiss up all the time. But there are people that are really false about it, which frustrates me. So, like I said, the guy who's the leader of our organization, we did a retreat for the public policy group at this law firm. And we asked him, "Okay, how did you become the great lawyer that you are now?" And he said, "Well, you know, I found out that this first client that I was going to have when I was a little lawyer really loved wine, so I learned everything I could about wine. And then so I could have these conversations with him about wine and did this." So, I mean, he totally subsumed himself to what he found out that this guy liked. And then he became the lawyer for this big company and all their spinoffs over time because he sucked up to this one guy. And we're like, "But what if you don't really care about that?" And he said, I swear to God, with the straightest of faces, that if you can't fake sincerity, what good are you? And we were like, holy shit. I mean, and that was it. And we used to have a guy who used to speak on our programs who said, I learned everything I could about Kentucky basketball so that whenever I ran into the hallways into Cal Rogers, I could talk to him about basketball. And then one time he called me in to ask about my company's issues. And, you know, all of a sudden that all paid off. And I was never into that style of lobbying, mm-hmm. but that there's a place for that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a place for that.
Yeah, for 6 years.
I did it for 6 years. The money was great. I mean, the kids went on a Disney cruise. We redid the kitchen. But as my wife said after I came to Government Affairs Institute, I mean, you got your soul back. And I'm like, yeah. Because she was a stay-at-home mom.
Yeah.
So I was the salary at that point.
She was listening to all your war stories.
she was seeing the depression hit, right? Because it's tough. I mean, that stuff does wear on you after a while.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you make the best of it. Again, don't weep tears for me. I was making very good money when I first came out, but then the recession hit. And
this is hired gun lobbying, right?
Yeah, like, all hired gun lobbying.
If you're in-house somewhere that you believe in, very different situation, right?
Even if you don't believe in it, if you're in-house, right, so you can sometimes get away with it.
Yeah, yeah.
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 And then
the Government Affairs Institute.
And then after a six-month unemployment stint.
Second unemployment stint of your adult life.
Third. Yeah, but who's counting? Because the Miller kind of thing was kind of there. Then I came here. Josh and I started about the same time. We were in the same interview process. I was actually, I had to hold JAI off because I was the number two for another job that I thought I was going to get.
Back on the Hill. Chiefing job?
No. It was actually to be the government affairs head for the National Science Foundation.
Oh, wow.
I was number two for that job in 2013.
That's a sliding door right there.
And
right?
I lost out to a woman who was the staff director of the research subcommittee for the Republicans in the House. Very good. She was very good. It was reasonable that they gave it to her. Before Miller let me go, I was the number two guy to be the head lobbyist for Duke.
Oh, wow.
And the guy that they hired is still there. Chris is good too.
In the House particularly, but Congress in general, there's so much moving around.
And that's what my career was, six jobs.
Yeah, when you're interviewing this stuff, how secretive is it versus how much does your boss know you're considering moving around?
I'm not sure if Williams's people knew I was interviewing. Then the move from Valentine was the same. Then coming into Price, I was coming from unemployment. When I was going to Price, the science committee, I did tell them that I was doing that, but that made sense because of the situation. The science committee to Miller, I think I let them know that I was doing that, but they kind of understood it. I mean, you really are kind of either a committee person or a personal office person.
Mm-hmm. But you weren't either. You were both.
Yeah. I was both, but weirdo.
But
I left the science committee. I mean, I got sent down to the science committee from a personal office.
Right.
And then I came back to the science committee because I needed a place to land.
But then you went back to a personal office.
Because I'm really not a committee person.
Yeah.
That's so unusual. I mean, what you find more often than not talking to staffers, it's committee office, their boss gets a job on a
personal office.
Their boss gets a job on a committee.
Right.
You go to committees and then you stay there for the rest of your life. Yeah. Right.
Well, you are as a house guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the problem. Well, I'm a house guy number one, and number two, I'm not a guy who does well learning a whole lot about one thing. I'm a guy who likes to juggle 16 balls at once, and keep track of a lot of different things. And that's why GAI has been great, right? All these different classes that we teach, all the different sessions that we have. All the different lectures I can give, basically, because I've done all these different things. I haven't done just one thing, because I get really bored doing just one thing. The fact that I've been here for 12 and a half years is pretty amazing. But
this
the
is
reason
your longest
why,
stint in any one place.
By three times, right? I was with Miller for just over 4 years.
And you loved it so much, you're retiring.
3 times. But I mean, it is... This stays fresh, right? Because we always have new things we have to learn. The Congress continues to change.
Yeah,
that's one thing I thought has been the most interesting of the things. Like, a Congress 12 years ago is, I mean, you can draw similarities to it, but God, it's different. Yeah. 12 years ago, 2013, we're in
God, it was the only Jesus Christ. 2013 was only 12 years ago.
The Freedom Caucus is like just forming. It's not even real yet.
2015, really?
Yeah, we're post Tea Party at that point.
Yeah.
And things are still relatively normal in presidential politics, right? I mean, it's just, it's crazy how much has changed within 12 years, even. Like, I mean, all of the talks that you give, all the classes that you give, especially the appropriations and budget, which is where your wheelhouse has been for a long time, it's like phenomenally different. Like, will the budget arrive on time? Absolutely not. Right? Will Congress pass a budget?
Yeah.
No. Especially not one that has anything to do with appropriations. I mean, it's just, it's amazing what's happened in 12 years.
So what was always fun is during our legislative and organization talk, we tend to do this kind of workshop-y part where we try to let our participants become members, right? And then tell us what committee you want to be on. And, you know, in 13, 14 maybe, that we were starting to see it go away, but every time, first committee up, appropriations, right? Because you could always do something. Now, most recently, I just did this. Not only did appropriations not come up, but I had one woman go, small business. I'm like, come on,
come on.
Foreign affairs? I'm like, no, keep trying.
Yeah.
Keep trying. But, I mean, it's interesting that people don't think of Congress as being able to really help the constituents anymore, and the committees where you really could, transportation, right? We're talking about earmarks, ways and means or finance, we're talking about tax policy, appropriations, to some degree energy and commerce, but not so much earmarks. But those first three, those committees don't have that ability anymore. And so it's not surprising that the members of Congress we have now are not as good as they used to be.
Well, one of the things that's interesting, I mean, we were talking about this a little bit yesterday, where the sort of cachet of, or the political capital that you use to get reelected is not so much goods anymore, like bridges, hospitals, community centers,
which it absolutely was when I was there.
Right. Now it's just grabbing attention.
Memes.
Right. It's memes. It's tweets. It's going viral. And, I mean, it's totally transitioned so many things about Congress and about politics. I mean, it's made it more superficial.
Right.
It's made it less...
local, for
sure. Less local.
Yeah.
Right? It's fascinating to watch the, like, intention economy take over
it's
Congress.
It's not clear to me what a big project in your district is worth anymore.
Right.
It almost feels like something that shuts down a primary challenger more than it shuts down sort of a general election problem, right? Mm-hmm. And from an electoral point of view. And, like, does anyone even care either way, right? The district likes the project, but, like, electorally doesn't even help you that much.
Because think back in the day. So, Alphonse D'Amato, senator from New York.
Sorry, who to what?
Alphonse D'Amato.
Senator Pothole.
Senator Pothole. Right? That's how D'Amato made his mark. In New York, he's a Republican, and a moderate but kind of conservative Republican in the state of New York who made his mark taking care of constituents. Jesse Helms. In a two-year period, North Carolina elected Jesse Helms and Terry Sanford. And you can go back and look these two guys up. Jesse Helms was Tea Party before Tea Party was cool.
Right.
And Terry Sanford was about as progressive as you can get on the Democratic Party. The state elected both of them back to back. Think about a state right now doing that. I mean, outside of Ohio,
Florida,
who's
Arizona?
I don't think there's nobody like Terry Sanford in Arizona right now.
Well, and okay, so Florida's got Maxwell Frost.
No, I'm talking about in the Senate. I'm talking statewide. These are statewide winners.
Oh, okay.
No. Yeah, individual pockets, absolutely, but statewide. So you have this going on, and Jesse Helms was known for having incredible constituent services. When I had friends who had issues because they were working for the census in 1992, and I was working for Valentine, right? They're like, can you help me get the pay I'm due from the census? I'm like, don't go to me, go to Jesse's people. Right? Jesse's people can help you figure out how to get your
Jesse's got the constituent services under wraps.
His constituent services was outrageously good. Now, his politics were way right-wing crazy. Yeah. And the state didn't necessarily support it, but they supported him because, I swear to God, one out of every 10 people, he'd help them or their family at some point. And that's where Elizabeth Dole screwed up, is she fired all of Jesse's constituent services people. So she only got elected once. I mean, that was in the race that Miller should have run for and won. Kay Hagan ended up winning. But yeah, I mean, that's the problem, right? If Congress can't actually help constituents, then what are we voting for?
Well, you know, it's not like constituents are looking for the same things, right?
Well, they're all looking for health care right now, right?
Sure, right? I mean, but some of them, that's 20 million, 30 million people spread out across the country.
Which touch
a lot.
100 million people total, right?
Touch a lot of people.
But I mean, when grandma's going to come into your basement, it's going to catch your attention.
And this is something that I've been interested in. It's like, how much does a constituent connection even... how much does it matter anymore? Uh-huh. I mean, because you have reasons to question it these days, with people bringing back dollars to the district, like getting earmarks, being involved in local politics. It doesn't seem to have the same grab that it used to. When you look at the numbers and you look at the kind of overall results of members who try to insulate themselves from national politics but just can't anymore.
Yeah, it's really hard. And also, I think the fact that the districts are so large now. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I started out, the districts are probably 550,000 people.
They're so you now got a quarter million people to every single
Yeah, day. They're just short of 800,000 now. And that's, so they've grown, at least in North Carolina. But I think that's nationwide. I think that's true.
I think the average is like 750, 760 now.
Yeah, right. I think that makes it a lot harder, too. I was actually talking to my dad yesterday, and we were talking about in North Carolina that that he was working on something called a fair. It's the fair in Chatham County, which is the largest or the longest run state fair or county fair by an African American organization in the country. And so he was the treasurer for a while as this white guy. It was kind of interesting. But what he said was, when I worked on the fair, what I learned about were people who are living five generations within 10 to 30 miles of each other. These are people who have never left this area. And that's true probably for like 70 counties in North Carolina. North Carolina has 100 counties. So for 70 counties in North Carolina, I said that's probably true for 70% of the country as well.
Right.
There's a lot, even though we talk about people flying all over the place and people moving for jobs, a large part of this country still is pretty much where it was, and you live fairly close to where your grandparents were. And I think the problem for the Democrats has been is they've totally lost track of that class and that segment of people, and they don't think about them and what their needs or importances are. And Trump found them, and he figured out how to drill down and to get their interest and their support, regardless of what his policies were. He understood what their concerns and their fears were, and he played to those. And I think politics right now, unfortunately, plays more to fears than it does to aspirations.
You know, coming from a guy who used to rival Helms staffers, I find that a little bit shocking. Good. Jesse Helms was... But
he played the fear. There's no doubt about it.
The point is true in a lot of respects. I mean, I keep saying this. One of the best books that I've read in the past year is Urban versus Rural by Susan Mettler and the other guy. I apologize to the other guy who wrote this book, but it's just a fantastic book. And she discusses how we've gotten to this point where like urban constituencies have become so Democratic and rural constituencies have become so prominently Republican, despite the fact that the policy differences between those places is very minimal. Even on like really controversial stuff, you're not outside of the ballpark on things like gay marriage or immigration. You know, 8-12 points. These are not like huge, cultural divides. You would presume when you look at the election results. I mean, they're profound, the differences right between those two places. And it is interesting that, you know, vibes is probably like a bad word for it, but like there's some sort of like cultural ingredient that does kind of lap onto partisanship in a way that's very profound and very telling in this current age. And it's something that I'm sure you...
It's a big change.
Right, yeah. You've experienced over time. It's something that we're watching. I mean, this goes back decades. I mean, you could find like the urban versus rural stuff in like the JFK Nixon election, right? It's not profound, but like it's not like it's new in American politics, but the fact that it's become so central to the division today is really interesting.
So let me talk real quick about North Carolina David Price's district. When I was his driver in 1988, driving him around for his campaign, his district was half rural.
Yeah.
And by the end of his career, the last decade, his district was all Raleigh and Chapel Hill. right. and partially Durham. I mean, it had come in dramatically. North Carolina went from 11 congressional seats to now 15.
Right.
And that's what's happened.
Very gerrymandered seats.
I mean, North Carolina's always done that. I mean, people are sitting here, though, oh, the Republicans are gerrymandering. Oh, come on, please. They learned at the feet of the Democrats. I mean, the Democrats in North Carolina were masters at doing this. They screwed it up in 92, and there were a couple of members who said, you're screwing it up.
Yeah.
They did what the Republicans are doing right now, which was they tried to cut it too thin to grab more seats.
Right.
And they lost 4 seats, I believe, in that election in 94, of which they got 2 of them back.
Yeah, there's going to be some dummy mandering that we're going to see in the next election.
For sure. I mean, anytime you base a map off a 2024 presidential election, and then you come into a 2026 midterm election with a different electorate,
you're going to see that.
You're going to see some missteps. Yep. They'll probably still, on the whole, gain seats in the place that they've gerrymandered, but it won't be maybe the number that they're expecting.
And now we're seeing gerrymandering everywhere, right? Was it Nathan Gonzalez who was talking about the fact that the Democrats may actually gain seats through
the depending on how things go. I mean, when the Texas maps were struck down originally, now they've been ratified by the Supreme Court, that looked like a complete backfire for the Republicans because that was the source of the major,
set of
plurality of the gains, right? Yeah, it was going to be those Texas maps. So, I mean, in equilibrium, it's a wash long term if both parties do this.
Right.
It is shitty, though.
It is.
Right? It's shitty in the respect that what you're doing is you're really distorting. I mean, we lament the Electoral College for giving all Electoral College votes to a single winner from one state.
Yeah.
Like, this is doing the same thing on the House side.
Yeah.
And it's really gross when you have, like, a situation where it's so lopsided that you're denying representation to an entire, like, political minority. Right, I think it's really distortive and anti-democratic in a lot of respects.
It's not
causing polarization, but it still sucks. Right, it's just bad.
It makes it really hard for the members too, if every 2 years they have a different set of people that they're trying to assist and work with.
Right.
I was the guy because we were the new 13th district. I actually had to go and get the maps, the McNally or whoever the city maps were, and draw block by block in Greensboro and Raleigh what the districts looked like, because none of us knew who our constituents were.
It's crazy.
Based on it. And nobody else wanted to take the time to figure it out.
Right.
And I found out at the time, and I can say this now because everybody's gone, but that one of the other members had their district office in our district. Mel Watt had his Greensboro district office in our district. Watt,
former HUD secretary?
No, he never. He was FHFA.
FHFA. Sorry,
he was. He never got quite that high, but Mel's, and I remember calling up Joyce and going, Joyce, I just want to let you know, I think your office is in. Yeah, I know. Okay. And they're still paying for it?
We're not moving offices.
Yeah, we're not moving offices, number one. They haven't figured it out yet. They're still paying the rent. It's all good. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to say anything. Thanks, bye.
That's great.
I mean, I will tell you, when I was with Price, this was the hardest thing. I was with Price, 97, 98, 99-ish, and 2000. I remember I started a First Friday Club. The first Friday of every month, I bring in bagels and cream cheese, and I get all the LDs for the Democratic offices to come together, and we talk about what was going on and try to think about things that were going on. I reached out to the woman who was the LD for Howard Coble from North Carolina, who was the highest, who was the longest ranking member from the Republican side. And I said, Missy, how about once every quarter we make this bipartisan? And let's try to get together. You know, other states do this. Sometimes they get bipartisan. She said, that's great. You reach out. I'm like, no. Missy, they're not going to listen to me. They're going to listen to you. She said, we don't like each other. I'm not reaching out to everybody. And that idea died on the vine. And that was more than 25 years ago. And it's only gotten worse since.
I think there's a lack of, for lack of a better term, like community building on Capitol
there's
Hill.
There's
almost
like, none.
You're right. They're, like the ability, like just doing what you're talking about, where you literally try to establish, spend some money, try to bring a place or create a place where people are likely to show up, whether they're Democrat or Republican.
And the reason why is we don't have freaking staff dels or codels. We don't allow outside organizations to buy us all dinner. I know. Oh my God, that would be awful. We used to have, AT&T would buy the chiefs of staff dinner one night. And all the chiefs of staff from all the different offices and the Senate offices would come together, and we'd have dinner. Actually, it was Bell South. We would have dinner together once a year.
Now you're dating yourself.
Right? I know. I know.
Loving is still dry. 2007.
This was 2003, 2004, right? And we've gotten to the point where we believe these outside organizations can't convene us together because, oh my God, we might do something to give them something. And it's like, I hear you, but what Josh, you just said is really true. And I will say that right. The reason why we don't build this community
Are you going to vote for something because my chief of staff went to dinner one time?
Right? I'm that cheap. But the reason why we don't have that community and we're not building anymore is because of goddamn cell phones. Because everybody, I swear to God, everybody looks at their cell phones all the time and they don't talk to each other anymore.
There's nothing more pertinent than a rant from somebody who's retiring.
Yes.
I'm an old guy.
Yeah.
We should probably wrap it up here.
If you haven't...
This is the longest Congress Beers of all time.
If you haven't told... Oh, no. This is Congress three beers in?
Right. Yeah, we're in the third.
There's exactly three people listening to this, and they're all in this room.
Yeah, no. Let me just say, to wrap up, I mean, this has been an incredible privilege to work with the two of you over time. I've learned an incredible amount. It's been wonderful, and it's been a great pleasure as well to do these. I don't remember whose idea this was. I'm going to claim it was mine, but it was
largely yours.
It was a great idea, and I look forward to being invited back as a guest on future episodes. So thank you very much, gentlemen, for all of your
learned a ton.
Yeah,
from you.
This is a great episode. It was great to hear your story and get it down on tape.
Thanks.
All right, that's it, everyone. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.
It won't be an hour and a half.